This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Gamar Joba, my name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Kartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Sakartvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled Sakartvelo. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
You are listening to the History of Persia podcast. And as we've been hearing from Trevor, the history of the Persian Empire is a story of Persian domination of much of the Middle East and Central Asia. But this was not the first time these lands were conquered, and it would certainly not be the last. I don't want to give too much away, but in the year 329 BCE, the important Persian city of Samarkand in modern-day Uzbekistan was conquered by some guy by the name of Alexander. But what's interesting about this city is that about 1700 years later, this same city, Samarkand, would be the glowing capital of an empire forged by a man known as Timur, or Tamerlane, or simply Timur. And Timur has gone down in history as a fantastic tactician, a man who supposedly never lost a battle, a great patron of the arts, and one of the most brutal conquerors of all time. From about 1365 until 1405 CE, Timur was almost constantly at war, building for himself an empire that stretched from modern-day Turkey to India, from Syria to the Russian steppe, and I want to know how and why this happened. If that sounds interesting to you and you want the story of Timur told by a guy who talks too fast and has loud neighbors, then check out my show, The Timur Podcast. Find out more about it at timurpodcast.com or listen to it in most places where you find podcasts. And with that said, take it away, Trevor.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America Secret Wars, the podcast all about the forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately covered up times that the United States used military force against foreign nations. I'm your host, Trevor Cully, and this is part two on how the United States fought Japan during the 19th century. If you haven't listened to part one, you probably can get away with listening to this episode, but why would you? That's why I number them. Before we get going, I have to repeat our required disclaimers from the last episode, because of who my guest is as a person. America, Secret Wars, and Hopful Media are not in any way affiliated with the United States Navy, the government, or the military. Any opinions expressed are our own as separate individuals. Evan, do you agree to these statements?
I agree.
Wonderful. We're being overly formal about this just to make sure that he doesn't get arrested or fired, which are kind of the same thing. Once again, I have no idea how the audio quality for these episodes is going to turn out because we are recording in our dad's gun-hunting bedroom closet thing that used to be where we slept in high school. Because my guest today is my brother, Evan Cully, on loan from the Navy for the first time in 3 years. How you doing, Evan?
Wonderful.
Look, he's improved, everybody. So I'm still kind of working on how to start part two on purpose, because my first, like, 3 episodes didn't do that. So within the restrictions of what you can legally tell me, what's the weirdest thing you've seen since joining the Navy?
Well, the weirdest thing I've seen I can't talk about. But the weirdest thing that I can talk about, is I've seen stars move.
What the hell does that mean?
So, you know.
For the record, my wife, his sister-in-law, is a planetary scientist. I am sure she will be very interested to know what Evan is talking about.
So, first thoughts when I tell people this is usually, you saw a satellite or something like that. Because when you're out in the middle of the ocean.
Or like a, you know, meteor breaking up, shooting star situation.
Sure, something like that. When you're in the middle of the ocean, you can see everything in the sky. There's no light pollution at all. Our whole purpose at night is to not be seen, so not even the ship itself is giving off any light pollution whatsoever. You can see the Milky Way. You can see everything.
That's pretty cool.
It's amazing. So there are definitely nights where we'll go and just like sit on one of the top decks of the ship and just look at the stars. And every once in a while out there, you see one that you think it's a star, and then it starts moving, and you go, oh, maybe it's a shooting star. Maybe the sky's clear enough tonight that I can actually see, like, some Verizon satellite up in the air or something. And then all of a sudden, it makes a right angle turn in a completely different direction on a dime. And then it'll blink, it'll turn and go a different direction, but they're not stationary.
Evan, would you describe this as a tic-tac?
Too far to say if it's a tic-tac or not, but...
All right, so unexpected, it's probably not aliens crossover. So you're saying you saw what you could describe as unidentified aerial phenomenon, or an unidentified flying object?
You could call it that, potentially.
All right, cool. So it's always the Navy with this stuff, too.
Yeah. I've seen... green flashes in the sky at night.
That's a real thing, though. That's a known...
Is that a known anomaly?
Phenomenon, yeah. I don't remember what it's called. But it's also a plot point in a Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Yes, it is. And it...
So you have seen people coming back from Davy Jones' locker?
Apparently I have, yeah.
All right.
It did look similar. Like, the whole sky lit up green for a second.
Yeah, I believe that is related to the polar auroras or something like that.
That's magnetic... what I figured it was, something along those lines.
Yeah, some kind of magnetic distortion. But that's really cool. Of course it was unidentified flying things. I should have guessed that.
Yeah, I've seen a couple.
Let's see. Well, we will not be fighting aliens in today's podcast. But we will be fighting Japan, where you have been stationed when you're not in the middle of the ocean. We left off in part one with the Convention of Karagawa, when Commodore Matthew Perry forced Japan's Tokugawa shogunate to open trade with the United States, further opening the floodgates to the end of 220 years of Japanese isolation. This led to a series of foreign treaties that heavily favored European powers over Japan, and was causing unprecedented economic and social turmoil within the country. One consequence of this was the individual feudal lords known as daimyo rearming themselves and becoming increasingly independent of the shogun. That was in 1855, and the United States of America celebrated this as a giant economic victory, in the years that followed, having access to Japanese ports allowed Americans to expand their presence in Eastern Asia as a whole, especially after we assisted the British and other colonial powers in the Second Opium War against China, which gave America preferential access to several ports on the Asian mainland as well in 1860. However, at that point, the U.S. was way, way more concerned with domestic politics. You see, Evan, this is probably something you didn't learn in high school. 1860 was an election year.
Mm-hmm.
And the winner of that election was a big, tall, skinny guy with a chin-strap beard and an oversized hat named Abraham Lincoln. You ever heard of this dude?
That was one of the few pieces that we touched on in high school, yeah.
Yeah, one of our high school teachers taught a whole class called Civil War History. And I understand if you don't know Lincoln. He's not up there with Millard Fillmore in the category of forgettable presidents. But the election of Lincoln, due in part to the fact that he was one Republican running against four Democrats, was the last step for a country that had been barreling towards civil war over whether or not we ought to own other people since its very foundation. There had been flashpoints before, especially in the 1820s, but they'd always smoothed over. Yet, as the U.S. expanded, the sheer amount of space in territory that had already been declared anti-slavery ran into Lincoln's election as an anti-slavery Republican until the very much less than United States exploded into civil war in 1861.
Yeah.
Now, the Civil War does fall firmly into the category of not at all secret wars, but there are definitely aspects of it that fit into this show. For example, even though the U.S. had been all over the Pacific coast for a decade, we never really think about the Civil War as having a West Coast feeder. In large part because it didn't. The whole East or Western seaboard was pro-Union, and there were some militia skirmishes in the Southwest, but nothing war-defining. But you've now spent the last couple hours with me talking all about American trade and naval presence in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So once we were distracted, American shipping became a target for piracy, including piracy by the rebel navy. So even the U.S. ships that remained in the Pacific were on high alert. Or this included the USS Wyoming, a steam-powered sloop commanded by David MacDougall, a 50-year-old veteran who had been in the Navy for his entire adult life. And Evan, I just want to show you a picture of this guy. You just want to tell the audience what you see.
I see a really old white dude with a white beard and mostly white hair. Kind of has the same hairstyle as, like, George Washington on his deathbed.
That is a good description. It's a real Santa Claus-looking guy. And this picture was taken, maybe a year after the story we're talking about today.
Oh.
So we've got a very old man in command of this USS Wyoming. If you were going to make a movie out of this, David was given one last big mission before his retirement in 1862, when he received orders to take the Wyoming across the Pacific in pursuit of possible rebel cruisers that were being sent to raid Union shipping. In reality, there was only one rebel ship, called the Alabama, and despite a few close calls that were discovered after the war, the two ships never actually saw each other during either of their Pacific deployments. And yet, the Civil War is the reason that David MacDougall and the Wyoming were in Asia to begin with when shit popped off.
Okay.
Through the late 1850s, backlash against Euro-American presence in Japan grew and grew as the shogunate's influence crumbled. A popular nativist movement rallied around the slogan Joey, or Expel the Barbarians. Then Tokugawa Yasuda died in 1858 and was replaced by the equally ineffective Yamauchi, who just happened to be married to the Emperor of Japan's sister. Now, this was Emperor Kume, who went by Osahito during his life. And like most of his predecessors for the preceding 200 years, he was basically just a figurehead.
Okay.
However, Osahito happened to agree with the Expel the Barbarians faction, especially because his only claim to power was Japanese culture. If Japan abandoned its traditional culture, they might just abandon the emperor with it. So, Osahito flexed the few remaining muscles he actually had by using his office to support the nativists. He didn't have the ability to enforce anything, but technically, the emperor could still issue commands that were law. So in 1863, the emperor issued the Joi Chokume, the order to expel the barbarians. And his supporters added a new element to their slogans. Revere the emperor, expel the barbarians.
Huh.
This order was issued in March and gave all foreigners until May 11th to evacuate the country. The problem was, this order could not be enforced by the emperor himself, and the shogun opposed it. So it was up to the individual daimyos to choose whether or not they were going to expel foreigners from their territory. In the places where there were a ton of, say, or American and British warships pointing guns at them all the time, the daimyo didn't do much. But in places with less foreign presence, there started to be incidents attacking foreigners in the streets, kicking them out of town, and things like that as soon as the decree went into effect. And in fact, similar things had already been happening for a few years. But the first major blow came in June, when Mori Takachika of the Choshu domain gave his troops orders to seize control of one of Japan's most important trade routes, the Shimonoseki Strait, also called the Kanmon Strait, which is a narrow strip of water between Honshu and Kyushu Islands. Have you sailed through there?
Through which islands?
Between Honshu and Kyushu, the big island and the southern island.
Oh, no, you can't really...
Yeah, I wasn't even sure if a modern ship could get through there.
I don't think you could.
It's not very big.
It's not very big at all. Like, there's bridges over it.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like... It's probably not even wider than the Panama Canal. It's probably thinner than the Panama Canal at some point. It's not a huge, like... It's barely a saltwater river at points.
Yeah, they are barely separate islands,
yeah.
But in the age of sail and, you know, very shallow draft steamships, this was considered a major trade point.
Well, yeah, I'm sure those old steamships, because, like, those old steamships could go up, like, the Mississippi and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, at this very moment in history, there were battles being fought on the Mississippi River.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure one of them could get in there. No issue, but, you know, modern ships, definitely no.
Funny how things change, because this was a big deal. The Choshu clan controlled the territory northeast of the strait on Honshu, which is the Japanese big island. Daimyo Mori gave the order for his forces to open fire without warning on any foreign ship passing through the strait. They were, at the time, a key artery for trade between Japan and China or Korea. And most of the weaponry in the Choshu arsenal was outdated round shot cannons. Think like classic pirate ship cannonball. But in a twist of irony, they also had 5 Dahlgren gun howitzers and 3 small steam-powered warships, all provided by the United States after the Convention of Karagawa, as well as a few European-made sailing ships. So the most powerful tools in their arsenal were all given to them by the people they wanted to kick out. So the first victims of Mori's campaign to expel the barbarians was an American steamship called the Pembroke. Per Mori's orders, the Choshu side fired on the strait without warning as soon as the merchants entered their waters from the east. Fortunately, they had just entered and were able to maneuver enough that they could turn around and take the long way south around Kyushu to reach their destination in Shanghai, where they informed the local American consulate, who sent word back to Japan that one of the daimyos was in open revolt and shelling random merchant ships. A few days later, the Choshu attacked a French ship in the straits once again, and the first real challenge to this blockade came just 2 weeks after that, when a Dutch warship approached Shimonoseki.
Mm-hmm.
The captain of this ship thought that this order against the barbarians couldn't apply to the Dutch. They'd been there for hundreds of years. Mori Takachika said bet, and his forces opened fire on a 16-gun corvette. The Dutch returned fire and then ran the fucking gauntlet all the way through the strait because they were carrying the Dutch consul and needed to escape quickly, not safely. 9 sailors were lost or wounded in the fight. And so trade through the Shimonoseki Strait basically came to a standstill, unlike the trade that comes through this show, in the form of advertising, which you are about to hear right now.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Well, welcome back. I don't have a funny stinger now because I didn't remember to write one and it's very late at night. There's a chance my brother might fall asleep on the microphone.
Getting there.
A few days after the Dutch battle with the Choshu, the American minister to the Tokugawa shogunate was able to get a hold of our friends on the USS Wyoming and pulled Commander David McDougall away from his fruitless mission hunting the American rebels to deal with some Japanese rebels instead. This was treated as an immediate threat to American citizens abroad, which frankly, it was. The more ethical solution might have been to say, these people clearly don't want us here, and leave.
Yeah.
But that's still a response to a threat. Fortunately, there's never been another example in the year of our Lord 2024 of angry rebel movements seizing control of a vital trade route with makeshift artillery barrages to expel the Westerners. Don't look at the news. So David called an all hands at 4:45 in the morning.
An all hands at 4 in the morning. Yeah, I'd be upset.
Well, unlike any all hands you've ever had, they were being called to be told they were about to go to war against Japan.
That's an acceptable reason for an all hands, I guess, that early in the morning.
They got, well, there is a catch. They then sailed for 2 days before they reached their destination.
That's not an acceptable time for an all hands. If you have 2 days in front of you before you're actually going to do it, you could have waited until, like, you know, 12 o'clock in the afternoon when everybody's already awake and, like, hustling and bustling. You have to pull people out of their racks in the early AMs to say, this is what we're going to be doing in 2 days. I'd be furious.
On one hand, declaration of war. On the other hand,
war. 2 days? Couldn't let me get my extra 3 hours of sleep? You had to tell me what we're going to be doing in 2 days?
Maybe much like the state, the USS Wyoming didn't have much going on.
No, I think the Navy hasn't changed that much in the past 200 years.
Well, 2 days later, at 10:45 a.m. on July 16th, 1863... the USS Wyoming fired signal guns as they approached the Choshu forces in the strait. They were approaching three American-made steamships, much like their own, though smaller and more poorly armed, as they raised their colors half an hour after firing their signal guns to give the sign that they were going to engage with the Choshu if they did not get out of the way. Just after the American flag went up, shore batteries on the Choshu side opened fire, and the Americans returned fire as quickly as they could, even as cannonballs soared through their rigging.
Huh.
Commander McDougal ordered his ship to keep sailing straight toward the Japanese, saying, basically, get the hell out of my way, or we will handle this medieval style and ram you. They did move, but only just enough to let the Americans into the strait. As in, they were so close to the Japanese ships on either side that the crews started exchanging fire with pistols from the deck.
Yeah.
Of course, because they were so close, any cannon fire was going to do significant damage, and one of the Choshu steamers fired its guns into the forward broadside of the Wyoming, immediately killing two sailors, wounding four, and sending shrapnel far enough that it killed a Marine on the other side of the ship. While trying to avoid artillery fire from the Choshu forts on land, the Wyoming sailed too close to shore and ran aground with its paddle wheel, because these are paddle ships, paddle-powered warships, jammed in the muddy bottom of the strait. At this point, the largest Japanese steamer had turned around and was now gaining on them, looking like they were preparing a boarding party. So some of the sailors were tasked with literally getting out to push and digging the wheel out of the mud so that they could get the ship moving again. Is that not a job you sometimes have to deal with, Evan? You don't have to get out and push on the ship?
No, if we're ever in a position where we gotta get out and push, we got bigger problems than we gotta push.
Well, these guys managed to get free just in time for their own ship to turn around its Dahlgren guns in their turrets and blast apart the Japanese steamer at point-blank range. And, unlike the Japanese, the Americans were much better practiced with all of their American-made equipment, and better trained. So they landed two direct hits on the Japanese steam boilers, which promptly began exploding. The Japanese ship was blown apart in the strait, and sunk to the bottom almost immediately as its crew abandoned ship. Now that they were feeling a bit more confident, David McDougal ordered the Wyoming to turn about and make another pass at the other two Choshu ships. This led to a near constant barrage of cannon and howitzer fire, on both sides, with the Americans deliberately arcing some of their shots over the enemy ships to bombard the surrounding artillery positions. They eventually made a direct hit on another boiler and sunk a second Choshu ship. They were not able to sink the third, but after an hour-long naval duel, they sailed back out the eastern side, nominally victorious.
Okay.
All told, the Wyoming suffered 5 deaths, 6 wounded, 11 holes blown through the side of its own hull, and both the smokestack and the rigging for its sails were basically useless. They were essentially now on board a giant raft, but they had technically won. Strategically, though, in the overall conflict over whether or not Japan should be isolationist, this didn't make a dent. The Choshu raised the 2 sunken ships from the bottom of the strait and installed them at a port as stationary artillery positions and just kept shooting anybody who came nearby. The Wyoming received extensive repairs before she could even try to leave Japan, and then went back to her original job as pirate hunting, looking for the Alabama. They would never find it, and eventually the next year, they were ordered to return to Philadelphia for proper repairs and to reinforce the Union blockade of the rebel coast, as the Confederate states started pouring out more and more blockade runners. Eventually, the Wyoming itself actually returned to the East India Squadron after the Civil War was over, and MacDougall retired. But just because the Wyoming was gone and the United States was busy with a little inconvenience like its own Civil War, didn't mean fighting in Japan was over. Just a few days after the Wyoming's assault, the French launched their own attack on the Choshu territory, landing Marines and burning a small village in retribution for the attack on their own ships. And this turned into a diplomatic crisis.
Yeah.
The Shogun obviously opposed the imperial edict, but there were popular riots burning throughout the capital and destroying foreign-owned buildings, including the U.S. consulate. By summer of 1864, both the Shogun and the foreign envoys were getting tired, and then the Choshu attacked an American merchant outside the Shimonoseki Strait. That became the last straw. 9 British warships, 4 Dutch, 3 French, all sailed for the straits. France, though technically busy occupying Mexico for some reason at the time, had a much more powerful navy than the U.S. and could send actual ships. The U.S. needed them at home to fight the Civil War, but they didn't want to be left out, especially because it was kind of our fault that Matthew Perry got everyone involved in this in the first place. Unfortunately, the East India Squadron at this point comprised of the USS Jamestown, and that's it. It was a squadron of 1.
No.
It was a tiny sailing sloop that couldn't get past the strong winds between China and Japan to actually participate. State of the art. So the U.S. consulate in China worked out a new solution, using possibly the weirdest vessel ever added to the Navy. An American-made 510-ton cargo steamer, crewed largely by Americans, under a British flag, in Chinese waters, with the Chinese name Taqiang. It was requisitioned for use in the Shimonoseki campaign of 1864 and outfitted with a single rifled artillery piece. Lieutenant Frederick Pearson and 12 men from the crew of the Jamestown were moved to what was now the USS Taqiang and ordered to assist however they could by towing boats, moving landing parties, etc., so long as they stayed out of range of the Choshu cannons. Which sounds to me like they wanted to get their deposit back on this boat.
Yeah, just stay alive, don't get blown up, no matter what. Keep doing work, just don't do dangerous work.
But have this one really big cannon, just in case. Despite being a token representative of the USA, the Takyang actually did participate in the battle. It arrived with the other ships at the Shimonoseki Straits, and fired 18 shots over the course of the fight, if only to make sure they weren't mistaken for a merchant vessel that had just kind of drifted into the middle of hostilities. They towed one of the French landing parties to shore when they went to assault one of the Japanese forts, and the American surgeon on board the Takyang treated the most seriously wounded British sailors when the fighting was over. This battle became an all-out siege against every Choshu position until they surrendered the strait entirely, led largely by the British and the Dutch, who accepted the daimyo's surrender after 2 days of fighting. They imposed a treaty that opened even more cities to foreign trade and required Japan to pay an indemnity of $3 million in 1864. Now, this had to be imposed on the actual government, because that's how governments work, which meant the shogunate was also pissed off at the Choshu daimyo, and invaded them by land a few months later. And all of this was going on simultaneously with the British fighting a small-scale war against the Satsuma domain further south in Japan. So, that is the story of the actual battle, Evan. Had you ever heard anything about that? Like, even just as weird trivia?
I think, isn't there a movie?
I think you're thinking of The Last Samurai.
Yes.
That's
different.
That is about a decade after this.
Yeah, that's like the only glimpse of this that I've, or at least a glimpse relating to this somewhat, same time period, I guess. But no, I'd never really heard about this.
Yeah. You'd think there'd...
I heard a little bit, you know, about
like Matthew,
us trying to open up trade with Japan, you know, trying to negotiate them opening up their borders, you know. Yeah. I knew that was a thing.
You heard, like, Matthew Perry rang a bell. The opening of Japan is something you at least probably, like, have a text box in a high school history book for.
At some point, probably.
If you're really into Japanese history, you've probably heard of the Black Ships. But, like, you'd think this would be, like, perfect history meme material. The U.S. fighting a war against Japan, or fighting in a war with Japan during our Civil War.
While we're fighting a war with ourselves.
But, like, I had not heard of this until I was looking through the congressional report on instances of force abroad. Like, just buried in there in a list of other things that will be topics for this show.
I think, wouldn't it have been cool? I mean, cool in a way that it's funny, but, like, you know, it's also not cool because it's war. But if, like, both ships, the Alabama and, what was the Confederate one?
The Alabama. The Wyoming.
The Wyoming, yeah. If the Wyoming and the Alabama, right, if both of them ended up in Japan, and then we had a Civil War battle on Japanese soil, I think that would have been pretty funny.
I mean,
if they ever made it that far. Because, yeah, I mean, you know, if we're responding to Americans abroad, then, you know, shouldn't both Americas want to help Americans abroad? I'm sure we had Confederate citizens who were over there.
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's definitely an aspect of that where maybe less likely in Japan because the U.S. government and the shogunate were so involved. But, like, there were probably a couple of times where they came close to encountering each other and having a civil war battle off the coast of China. Like, that
yeah,
almost
exactly.
Happened,
like,
a few times.
Even just a battle, like, in the waters.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a weird historical twist?
Especially, like, from the perspective of, somebody on the Chinese or Japanese coast, wherever they are witnessing this, just out of nowhere, these two American ships just start shooting at each other.
Yeah, I mean, like, one would have been flying the stars and bars, but, like...
Still.
Yeah. Even weirder if they ran into each other in port or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
you just see a bunch of Americans all of a sudden
start drawing. Killing each other?
Yeah. No, this whole story is weird, because in hindsight, the Shimonoseki conflict, the order to expel the barbarians, and all of these other little conflicts between Westerners and the Japanese daimyos, they all, even if nobody recognized it at the time, were setting the stage for everything that happened in the Pacific for the next 100 years. In the U.S., this demonstrated that we could keep our eye on the ball of foreign politics even during the Civil War, literally the lowest point in American stability for political history. And in Japan, this was the harbinger of things to come. The emperor, the daimyos, the shogun, they all learned that Japan, as it stood in 1864, could not challenge European powers. They learned that they could not roll back the status quo to before Matthew Perry showed up and force everybody to leave them alone. It wouldn't work anymore. However, it also showed that there was a sizable force within the Japanese populace that didn't like the shogun, that did support the emperor. And if they couldn't kick the Westerners out, they could form alliances with Western powers against the shogun. And it also showed them that if they wanted to become competitive in this new version of world politics, they had to get up to the cutting edge just like all of the European powers. This eventually led to the Boshin War, which is the thing Evan mentioned with the movie The Last Samurai, and the Meiji Restoration, when a coalition of daimyos rallied around the ultimate power of the emperor, threw out the shogun in 1869, and effectively founded the Empire of Japan as it would exist for most of the following century. They did this with literal boatloads of Western aid, and ultimately they benefited from decades of American and French military advisors assisting Japan as their ally in the region and a check against Russian expansionism, which allowed the Japanese to hone their powers as the premier naval force in the Pacific Ocean. And frankly, one of the most successful navies in the world for a few decades. Obviously, those are all events that are way too big to just kind of cram in here at the end of an episode. But there is a through line, like I've been saying all through these episodes, from the lesson Japan learned in 1864 to Japanese imperial expansion in the 20th century that culminated in World War II. Which was, of course, the next time the U.S. Navy would fight against Japan and bomb the home islands. There's too many what-ifs involved, but I think there's definitely a version of history where Japan's isolationism ended in a different way, that either left the country much less prepared to deal with foreign intervention, or in a weird way, didn't give the United States a clear ally to establish ourselves in Eastern Asia and made us look elsewhere, which are both things that would dramatically have altered world politics in the decades that came after this. So, yes, Evan, that is the direct line from President Millard Fillmore to the nuclear bombs dropped on Japan.
Which is a direct line to the creation of anime.
Oh, I think it was on an episode of the Lions Led by Donkeys podcast. I want to give them credit for teaching me this. I listened to recently that talked about the political cartoons from this era that we were talking about in these episodes. One of the things that Japanese political cartoons really liked to do was make themselves look more white. because they were also trying to appeal to Western audiences that would see them in port. You know, look, we are more civilized than the Koreans or more civilized than the Chinese. They, you know, trying to be the good ones, basically, which never works. But then you get to this where they're at conflict. And this especially took off during the Russo-Japanese War in the early 1900s, where they're in conflict with white people, so they can't make themselves look like white people in the posters, because those are the bad guys. So they give Japanese people in those political posters really exaggerated features, and you get anime out of it. Like, that's where the art style comes from, is Japanese political cartoons in the early 1900s, where they had to shift away from more realistic-looking figures to differentiate between Japan and China and Russia.
Huh. That's funny.
But yeah, actually, very direct through line from this stuff to that, and from this stuff to the bombs, and from both things to anime. So, yes, you heard it here first, folks. Millard Fillmore invented anime.
The least known U.S. president is directly responsible for the creation of anime.
I mean, very, very indirectly, but yes.
No, pretty much directly.
Well, on that note, it's only been like an hour for us, but is there anything you want to plug?
Go donate to the Navy and Marine Corps Relief Society so that I can walk in and get a no questions asked loan so that I can go buy a Supra.
Yes, that.
And also to help sailors and Marines everywhere.
Right. I will be checking before I approve that donation plug. Also questioning how it lets you buy a muscle car. In the meantime, if you want more information about this podcast, go to secretwarspod.com or follow on social media at History of Persia, because I'm not going to set up two social media accounts. If you want to financially support my projects, you can do that with the donation link in the description of these episodes or by going to patreon.com/historyofpersia. And until next time, learn something about Millard Fillmore, unsung hero of world culture. See ya!
Africa is a land with endless stories to tell. From epic battles, brilliant rulers, and the dramatic rise and fall of civilizations, join us on the History of Africa podcast to learn the oft-ignored stories of the African continent. From the sands of Cairo to the plains of Zimbabwe, and from the mountains of Ethiopia to the forests of the Congo, find the History of Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to the History of Persia podcast. And as we've been hearing from Trevor, the history of the Persian Empire is a story of Persian domination of much of the Middle East and Central Asia. But this was not the first time these lands were conquered, and it would certainly not be the last. I don't want to give too much away, but in the year 329 BCE, the important Persian city of Samarkand in modern-day Uzbekistan was conquered by some guy by the name of Alexander. But what's interesting about this city is that about 1700 years later, this same city, Samarkand, would be the glowing capital of an empire forged by a man known as Timur, or Tamerlane, or simply Timur. And Timur has gone down in history as a fantastic tactician, a man who supposedly never lost a battle, a great patron of the arts, and one of the most brutal conquerors of all time. From about 1365 until 1405 CE, Timur was almost constantly at war, building for himself an empire that stretched from modern-day Turkey to India, from Syria to the Russian steppe, and I want to know how and why this happened. If that sounds interesting to you and you want the story of Timur told by a guy who talks too fast and has loud neighbors, then check out my show, The Timur Podcast. Find out more about it at timurpodcast.com or listen to it in most places where you find podcasts. And with that said, take it away, Trevor.